I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Make room on your bookshelf in your summer reading for Elena Ferrante, the novelist of Naples, the match of Dickens in London, Victor Hugo, or Proust in Paris, except that Elena Ferrante is a woman today in the very male dominion of Italy south of Rome. And the modern female gaze makes all the difference. There's mystery in Ferrante, starting with who she is and history too, but the pulse inside this Neapolitan quartet of novels is the raging friendship of two women in a cage of squalor and fear, rock fights and then round-the-clock beatings, a long habit of violence at war with beauty, love, and ambition. Among the special effects of Ferrante Fever is that it takes readers one by one back to fourth-grade crushes wherever you went to school, girls, boys, all the stages of your life, and my life too. And then comes the compulsion to talk about Ferrante's people. At the Reader's Cafe called I Am Books in Boston's North End, on any given Saturday afternoon, the conversation can sound like this.
You really feel like you know these people. It's an epic. It's unbelievable.
Took me 2 weeks. It was a marathon instead of watching, you know, like the Game of Thrones marathon. I couldn't stop. And again, I'm Italian-American as well, so I can see a little bit. And I grew up in New York. It's like opium for your eyes, like a heroin. Like you're just addicted and you just can't stop.
It's readable in Italian and in English.
Yeah, it really is.
It has a different meaning for me in the sense that I am Italian-American. But I do like the interplay of the relationship between Lila and Lenu. It's interesting because I do think that we explore ourselves by our relationships with others and through our friends.
It's very difficult. I mean, who of us still have childhood friends if you don't have anything in common anymore with them? You studied, she didn't. You get married, you got a child, and she didn't. It's difficult.
Right, but to what extent do we exist if someone else isn't observing us or recognizing it?
Like, do they even exist without one another?
Our own Mary McGrath recorded those voices, and there's more to come. Megan O'Grady is leading us toward the Elena Ferrante frontier this hour. She's book editor at Vogue magazine, and she drew the virtually invisible author into a fascinating email conversation on where the novels come from. Megan, welcome. You're the only one in this hour, the only one I know, who has felt Elena Ferrante in a sort of conversation. What's to share off the top?
Well, I think, first of all, to correspond with someone like Elena Ferrante is sort of like talking to the oracle, it felt like, just to see her name appear in my email box. And, you know, there's another funny thing about interviewing someone like Ferrante, aside from her anonymity, is that the books have a way of answering their own questions. There are so many things, you know, from her attitude toward her feminism through her reasons for choosing to be anonymous that are actually kind of embedded and explained in the books themselves.
Toward her writing? But what were you thinking of, for example, that you learned?
Well, I mean, there are so many things that, you know, honestly, I could have published the email back and forth in its entirety because she's so, you know, so such a beautiful writer and so wonderful at articulating the things that we love her for. And, you know, I've been so struck by the appeal of these books to so many people, men and women across different ages and experiences. And, you know, some of it is, of course, you know, the prose itself, which is absolutely devoid of pretension and this craft. But the thing that I think that we all really are responding to here is something that she told me in the interview, which is that writing for her is a battle against lying. I think you feel that hard-won truth as a reader. These are books that bring up strong feelings, especially for women who are ambitious or creative. They speak to a range of familiar experiences, such as the jealousy of a friend who has a different kind of intelligence or a different kind of beauty, for example, or the guilt of the smart girl who leaves her family and her provincial origins behind. And then there's just this very deep satisfaction that comes with following these two girls and then women, Lenu and Lila, throughout their lives. The friendship is given a deep seriousness that we don't always see in literature, the friendship between women being given that level of seriousness. And we see how this original wound, the fact that Lila is denied an education, and how that kind of fatefully reverberates.
Speaking of the granular beauty of the prose and the not lying and the female gaze, I mean, here's a tiny sample. They meet in first grade. As Lenu writes, Lila appeared in my life in first grade and immediately impressed me because she was very bad. Her quickness of mind was like a hiss, a dart, a lethal bite. She was disheveled, dirty. On her knees and elbows, she always had scabs from cuts and scrapes that never had time to heal. Her large, bright eyes had a gaze that appeared not very childlike and perhaps not even human. Every one of her movements said that to harm her would be pointless because, whatever happened, she would find a way of doing worse to you.
Well, one thing, I mean, that's a beautiful description of Lila and this kind of quicksilver, slightly terrifying intelligence that she has. One thing that Ferrante told me was, or wrote to me, was that when she was 12 and she was in school, she had a very good friend, her desk mate. And her desk mate, her friend decided or suggested that they write a novel together. And together they made up a story. And they each decided that they would write a chapter and the friend would start. And so then Elena read the chapter. She did not like it. And so she wrote the entire novel herself from beginning to end and then lied and told her friend, you know, that she had loved the chapter but just didn't feel like she had the courage to go on. And that really was kind of an origin for her as a writer and perhaps also the origin of this book.
In the novel, too, I mean, they've read Little Women by Louisa May Alcott, and they think they might just strike it rich.
Yes, yes. Yes, it's true.
Can I ask, what shelf do you put these books on? I mean, women's literature, all-time classics, modern, specifically 21st century breakthroughs, or where do they go? Or do they go in history or anthropology or psychology?
Well, it's true there is almost an ethnographic quality to the way she describes post-war Naples. And again, that's another part of the appeal of the books is this sort of, you know, the way in which we see this kind of social and political upheavals of Italy throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s. For me, where we classify the books, you know, this isn't the kind of question that really preoccupies me or interests me, you know, as a critic. But for me, of course, they are classics. They are, it's sort of unusual. I can't really explain why she hasn't won more prizes.
She didn't win the Booker Prize this week. That was
a shock
to me. But connect her with others. People say Jane Austen. I came to her through Karl Ove Knausgård. And I sort of, in recording from Knausgård, people said, nah, he's not the Norwegian guy. Come on. This woman from the south of Italy is it. And she is it. But I feel Dickens in her. Obviously Proust from a straight woman's perspective. But where else would you go in locating antecedents?
Well, I mean, you know, she would – I know that, you know, her influences are very clearly Elsa Morante, and you can see kind of her name is sort of taken from that as well, Elena Ferrante, Elsa Morante.
A friend I have yet to meet. People – she turns up in the novel as sort of the mother of us all, but what does that mean?
What does that mean in terms of
who else?
Elsa Morante. I mean, she's a great Italian author and feminist. And I think it was the book House of Liars that was the book that Ferrante read at 16 that sort of multiplied her ambition. I guess I'd put it that way. Before that, I think she'd read Confessions of an Italian by Ippolito Nievo. She told me that she grew up in a household with very few books, and that she grew up in Naples, and that she just was constantly taking books out of the library. She hated when a novel ended, and she would just read it and reread it and reread it, and that was her key to her development as a reader. And she read indiscriminately, high and lowbrow. Mm. And that's something that's interesting. When you read her books now, there's this kind of seamless quality to the prose and this strong will to kind of not have any pretension. That said, there are moments of kind of supreme strangeness in the book, you know, that kind of puncture this realism. There's a moment when a copper pot explodes in the first book. And then I think it's in the second when a portrait of Leela bursts into flames, spontaneously combusts. I hope whoever films the miniseries that they will somehow include
a maxi-series. Speak of two specific Ferrante effects. There's one. I'm back in the fourth grade. All these names came back to me. Ann Barker, Ann Cheney, Eddie Deleuze, Ronnie Crowe, Wayne Nudd, Wayne Ricker, Frank Nudd, etc. But we're back in the schoolroom and we realized we felt particular strong things about everybody in that room. But there's another effect, and maybe it's the not lying. She does sort of assure you there will be no lies in this book. We're telling everything. Candor, fearlessness. It somehow encourages the reader, puts you in a different place. This is not a yarn. How do you describe the effect?
You know, I think that's true. You know, I'm thinking back to your comparison to Knausgård, who also does childhood very well. And it's hard not to compare the two because they are sort of, multi-volume, narratives of the self and coming into being as a writer and a person. And one is very, very masculine in a certain way, and one is very feminine. I mean, one is, you know, my struggle, the sixth volume, you know,
as
with,
if we cared,
his name.
Carlo. Yeah. No, but he assumes that he owns the territory. She assumes that she has to do something marvelously interesting in the territory, and maybe then she'll have a claim on us. But it's entirely different. She wins for me.
She's more crafted, and she's also anonymous, and that says a lot right there.
Stand by, Megan O'Grady. Coming up, Between the Lines with Elena Ferrante, there seems to be one woman's history of 40 years of feminism. This is Open Source. We read the Neapolitan novels of Elena Ferrante in translation from her Italian. It is Anne Goldstein, an editor of the New Yorker magazine, who gets high marks everywhere for catching the headlong pace of the original, also for decoding words that have no English equivalent. Here is the translator who's caught Ferrante's voice without ever meeting her.
It's me trying to capture Ferrante and not go too far out of English, but also to capture that quality of rushing, of sort of mounting intensity, which I think sort of requires something of a run-on sentence.
Anne Goldstein, take one word that everybody focuses on, this smaginatura. It may be the key to the whole book, this permeability of personalities, but literally the bleeding of borders. Take it apart.
It's a word from printing. I'm actually not sure if it's bleeding margins or cutting off the margins. It's not a normal Italian word used in that sense. But she uses it to describe this experience of Leela's, of people's margins dissolving. The first way that I translated it was, of course, very literal. And I said, trimming the edges. Well, obviously, it's not trimming the edges. It's something more dissolving. Then I said, losing the edges, dissolving the margins. I think dissolving boundaries is what I came up with in the end.
And here are the book club women in the North End getting their heads around smarginatura.
The very beginning of the first book, I don't remember what the word was. I think it's like blurring of the margins, where she feels like she's disappearing or she wants to disappear. Or she's just like being merged in with her husband.
It's a printing term.
Like smudging.
Isn't the Italian word like smarginatura?
Yeah, smarginatura.
It's called smarginatura.
I think it's like she's lost her individuality. She has no control over her life. So that smarginatura is her describing how she's melting into her husband, into her surroundings. She does not have the ability to take control and do what she wants to do.
She was just almost like a mental illness, like just losing herself and no boundaries, like just kind of flowing into everything and everything flowing into her as well.
It's a very complicated idea. So the beginning of the first book was that she disappeared, yeah, and that it seems to be her deeper wish. Mm-hmm. Then we discover that through her entire life, she has this experience of this smarginatura. Mm-hmm. That means it loses her margins, the boundaries within herself and the rest of the world, or herself and someone else. Mm-hmm. And then again, she never go out of the rione, of the neighborhood. Right. She doesn't want it to go because that's where her margins are, maybe, yeah, boundaries are, sure. But also in the rione, she is fighting to keep her boundaries. Yeah, it's a powerful word, smarginature, which I don't know how to...
Which doesn't really have
any translation.
Yeah.
Almost like getting rubbed out, yeah, being erased.
Yeah.
Those are the Saturday ladies at the I Am Books Cafe in the north end of Boston. Dana Tortorici joins us from Brooklyn. She's co-editor of N Plus One. Can I say the hipper than hip culture mag? Dana, welcome.
Sure.
So many themes.
Welcome
and thank you. So many themes of everything in that one word, smarginatura, you know, emotions, personalities, territories. Can you leave Naples and come back? Can you stay? Where do you begin with Elena Ferrante, your favorite Ferrante, your take-home Ferrante?
My favorite Ferrante, you mean passage or book?
Yeah, as you like, if you'd read your bit.
I will read to you. So I have a little piece from near the end of book one. And this is, for context, Lanu has written an essay, or I think it might be a newspaper article, and Leela has, you know, since what Megan called the original wound when she's denied an education at fourth grade because her father says she can't study anymore, she must work in the shoe shop, has pretended that she's not interested in reading and writing, and yet you can tell she's naturally gifted in these ways. So after being disinterested in these things supposedly for so long, she offers to basically edit this thing that Lanu has written.
Hmm.
And so this is an interaction between them. And Lanu is very terrified because she's intimidated by Leela, imagines that all of her gifts as a writer and as a person actually just come from Leela, they belong to Leela. Hmm. So Leela looks up at her and says, "Can I erase?" "Yes." She erased quite a few words in an entire sentence. "Can I move something?" "Yes." Hmm. She circled a sentence and moved it with a wavy line to the top of the page. When she gave me back the notebook, she said, "You're very clever. Of course they always give you 10. I felt that there was no irony. It was a real compliment. Then she added with sudden harshness, "I don't want to read anything else that you write." "Why?" She thought about it. "Because it hurts me." And then she struck her forehead with her hand and burst out laughing.
Mm. Mm. It reminds me, if I may say, of that wonderful scene early on when she's a hellion in class. She sends these kind of ink-soaked spitballs all around the room. She injures her teacher, and the teacher...
She's the original writing terrorist with these ink paintballs, basically.
Yeah, and the teacher says, despite everything, she's the best of the lot of you.
Yes.
And she then asks her to write a word, the first grade, and she can spell it on the blackboard. And she said, "Chiruro, where did you learn that? Who taught you that?" And she hesitates a bit, this dark-spirited girl in a dark dress. And finally she says, "Me."
Mm-hmm.
"I taught me that." An early moment of triumph. Dana, would you've written extensively in N Plus One about Ferrante and these novels as a sort of autobiography of feminism, a workable feminism at the end of a long search. Describe that process that we're led through in the book.
Yeah, so what's interesting about these books is that they're unequivocally feminist books.
Meaning
that they are books told from the perspective of strong women in the interests of women who are strong or wish to be strong, and in that way advance the idea, which should not be radical but is, that women are autonomous beings who deserve to have their stories told and deserve to be protagonists. And I think that Ferrante's idea of who the hero of history is, or who an important creature is a person who is a protagonist. She mentions in one interview, I don't remember if it was in Megan's, when someone asked her if she was a feminist and what feminist literature was important to her, among the names that might be more familiar to American audiences, including Shulamith Firestone and Donna Haraway, she mentioned an Italian feminist named Adriana Cavarero, who wrote a brilliant book about the importance of narrative in the definition of selfhood, and how a person, what makes a person a unique existent in reality is their desire to express their own story. So I think for her, that's what feminism is the desire to express your own story and your ability to express your own story.
Megan O'Grady, does that work for you?
I would absolutely agree. I mean, you know, I did ask Ferrante about how sort of she sees her work in relation to her feminism. Because in, you know, by the last book, Lenu has, of course, become a well-known feminist voice in Italy. But what Ferrante does so brilliantly is kind of, very ironically contrast the principles of equality she's espousing and the reality of her life at that moment in which she feels quite powerless. And so when I had this exchange with Ferrante about feminism, you know, she said, of course, you know, ideology is necessary when waging cultural and political battles, but it's limited. It's a kind of veil, was the term she used, when we're talking about literature and about telling a story truthfully. But that, you know, to go to Dana's point, the hardest thing, what we see in the book is that the hardest thing is to see oneself, to name oneself, to imagine oneself clearly. Even free from the boundaries that point the way to liberation.
There's a moment in the third book, highly politicized time in the 70s, I suppose, maybe Milan, but a writer named Carla Lonzi is held up as the model, and especially an essay she wrote called We Spit on Hegel. And Lenu is thrilled. Spit on Hegel, spit on the culture of men, spit on Marx, on Engels, on Lenin, on historical materialism, and on Freud, and on psychoanalysis, and penis envy, and on marriage, on family, blah, blah, blah. But find your own space. Woman is the unpredictable subject. Free oneself from subjection here, now, in this presence. And Lenu reflects to herself, she says, no one knew better than I did what it meant to make your own head masculine so that it would be accepted by the culture of men. That is the long struggle, isn't it, Dana?
Yes, I think so. I love that passage so much because I think that whole third book is wonderful in this way, in that you really start to recognize the world historical political events of that era intersecting, which are, you know, true in the sense of existing in non-fictional reality, intersecting with this narrative. And I love that particular moment so much because it's so truthful to the experience of, one thing that I think is very interesting about feminist philosophy and feminist politics is that, you know, no one is born a feminist. The history of feminism is recapitulated with every individual because, of course, you know, even if your mother is a feminist, you reject your mother, and so you reject everything, and you need to really come to it on your own. And Lenu, like young women even today, you know, susses out the fact that to be taken seriously, to advance, especially in the sort of upward mobility narrative that's also operative here, in order to finish school, to go to college, to leave the neighborhood, she needs to think, she needs to get 10s, she needs to get straight A's, which does not include thinking outside the box or thinking in a way that is against the male dominant regime. And so when she, as an adult who has already won middle class respectability, she's reading this passage where I think she's like breastfeeding on a bench and is discovering it for the first time, she has this breakthrough, like, oh my God, I didn't realize that I had been doing this to myself the whole time.
Mm.
And it's this, you know, I think all of the books are about female experience, and but there's only a small portion of them that are about feminism as, you know, capital F feminism. But
I wonder, can I ask you, Dana, where does that clearing of the space, which takes such a lot of struggle, where does it deliver these women, Lenu and Lila? Very different, obviously. Lila fights for it, literally in battle, political battle, personal battle, husband battle, back in Naples. But where does it take Lenu either? You know, both of them.
Well, I think that for both, what is so striking about that particular Lonzi argument is this is sort of the high point of what's called difference feminism, which is a sort of feminism that emphasizes the difference between men and women as very important, and it's not that the rights of men need to be extended to women, but that women are constitutionally different and that the feminine, the female, needs to be honored. And so I think that with embracing this idea of the female and the feminine, where it actually kind of leads them is into a formulation of motherhood that is unconventional and yet still functional and happier than either of them would have had if they had been married to their first husbands, abused, and so forth. They end up kind of rearing their children together in a kind of like quasi-feminist collective / old school living next door to your family kind of way. They're very involved in collaboratively raising their children. And you could say this is a very feminist model, and yet she doesn't put too fine a point on it. So I think it leads them to a respect for their mothers in a way that they didn't have, because to them, being their mother meant being trapped in the neighborhood, meant being abused, meant being not the protagonist, and both of them wanted to be the protagonist. And so learning that you could love the figure of the mother, be the strong mother, and yet still be the protagonist is a very radical thing.
Being the protagonist, Megan O'Grady, you know, resolving all that anger with mother. What is the example here for women readers?
I think feminism tends to be kind of a messier thing when it's applied to real life. And I've been kind of curious to see how women have responded so differently to the kind of models of women, how they've responded to the mother with her limp, which haunts Elena, and how this idea of women needing to be kind of a little more perfect that Dana sort of alluded to in order to succeed, in order to be relatable. And that's something that's still, and even in our culture, is true, I think. You know, I have a good friend of mine, a Hollywood producer who would definitely call herself a feminist, who has daughters, and who said to me after reading the third novel, like, but didn't you lose sympathy for Elena when she left her husband? And isn't she making a big mistake? And to me, you know, that was somewhat horrifying to hear. Elena, for me, was never more sympathetic because the stakes are so high. And Ferrante, what she's doing there is linking kind of creative agency with desire and having the courage to act on it. And that's something that I think is still very difficult for many women.
I have to say, I wondered if Lenu was losing it in the third volume and the fourth. Something's coming apart there. But then, meantime, her writing is becoming very successful. She's feeling successful.
Well, I mean, you know, as Dana alluded to, you know, in the end, in the fourth book, part of the big pleasure of reading that book is that, you know, Lila and Lenu are together again and very interdependent. You know, Lenu's success as an author becomes dependent on Lila in many ways, childcare and also kind of helping her kind of feed her stories of the neighborhood and how it works.
I think they're acting out an amazing sort of definition of what critics have always meant by the female gaze. The tolerance, the long-term nature of that friendship, the support despite everything. Lenu looks at Lila and says, I know she would wound me desperately with words, and under the right circumstances, the wrong ones, she would kill coldly. Dana, I mean, but the fact that they stick together, they remain in touch almost to the end, there's a tolerance, there's a groundedness in that friendship. I can't imagine it between men.
Oh, that's so interesting. I wonder if I'm allowed to say this, but
anything goes.
Anything goes. Okay. Well, there was a wonderful interview in the Paris Review with the publishers of the Ferrante novels, Sandro and Sandra Ferri, and their daughter and Ferrante. And I was talking to the editor of the Paris Review, Lauren Stein, who mentioned that there was, you know, a part that was cut from the interview was about how Ferrante was very interested in the relationship between Wordsworth and Coleridge. And so I think she's actually very interested in the kind of productive animosity, or not quite animosity, but the creative tensions between great thinkers. And I think she thought there are women for whom this is true, and yet the dominant narrative is two men hustling it out. So I think it exists.
Dana, hold it there. Taking a break. Coming up, the Ferrante resonances around the very wide world of women writers and readers. This is Open Source. Elena Ferrante is book group bait for all sorts of questions. Who is she, for starters? And did she write these books from 50 years of her own scrapbooks? It's not just the North End, either, that talks Ferrante. In Central Square, Cambridge, it sounds like this.
I felt like I was reading Desperate Housewives of Naples. Okay.
A little bit about the treatment of women, and whether this is feminist or whether this is 50s or whether this is Italian or whether it is socioeconomic, because these girls got married with no expectation of their husbands actually treating them well. Mm-hmm. None at all. Their mother-in-laws, their mothers, their fathers. And I'm not sure that's feminism or it's this very limited village with kind of no way to get out of patterns that are almost ancient.
A lot of people say this is about women. This is a moving exposition of the way women are friends.
Sexist male patriarchy.
That's what I think. In a sexist male patriarchy. To me, it strikes me that men might say that this is about women friends. But if this is what men think that women's friendships are like, we have a long way to go.
On Twitter this week, we asked who else wanted to talk Ferrante. Best answer was the young Indian novelist Nilanjana Roy, a close Ferrante reader, who came in on Skype from New Delhi.
Right from the first paragraph, you know that you want to follow that voice anyway. You know, you'll follow it into a country and a city that you don't really know that much about. But I think two things. One is the really interesting connection with Jane Austen and her. And I think that's because they're both women who separated by centuries, right, with a complete lack of embarrassment, with absolute confidence, not just about the lives of women, but about female friendships. You know, that's something that people say often about Ferrante. But getting to the question of why her appeal cuts across the globe, I think it's extraordinary because when I was sitting here, I had the same sense of affinity that I would when she was describing the poverty in Naples, and particularly the sense of danger. You know, there's a fantastic paragraph where she says the words that we feared, you know, and she has an entire list of things from tuberculosis to bombs. And you recognize that wherever you are in the world, if you've been in a part of the world that's even been remotely unsettled, you say, yes, that's familiar. That could be coming out of the chawls of Bombay or the slums of Delhi, or it could be coming out of, you know, any part of the world that's gone through the least bit of shakeup. And at the same time, it's Italy. In my case, Italy was a place that I associated with museums and fine art and Florence. And here was this completely different side to it.
I want you to just sort of carry on that female difference. It's an incredibly different eye.
I think it's because she's a great writer on the subject of power and where it comes from and who has it. Mm. You know, whether it's in a neighborhood, whether it's between women arguing over who owns what part of the street, or whether it's in a marriage. If you think of the people whom you're closest to and whom you honestly, you know, love with all your heart, aren't those also the most, not fraught, but they are the most furrowed relationships? There's always the fear that the person you love most might leave you behind or might not be thinking in exactly the same way. Between women, there's both that solidarity and bonding, and there's the competitiveness. You know, there's the section where she says about Leela, is she always going to learn things faster and better than me? She captures an essential truth about relationships. The men hold the territory, but they hold that at some level, their power can be obliterated by a woman who uses her own power in a different way, you know, not just sexually, but also to challenge them intellectually. And I think that's, again, what she does. She puts women's minds back at the center of a book. It's a very bodily book. It's a very, I mean, all the books, they are fleshly and they're bodily. But they're also so much, they insist that a woman's intellectual view of the world and the way she experiences the world intellectually is important.
That was Nilanjana Roy in New Delhi. Consult our webpage, radioopensource.org, for the woman herself and her work. Megan O'Grady writes for Vogue magazine, Dana Tortorici for N+1, both authorities on Elena Ferrante. I heard there a wonderful definition of sort of the feminist objective, this a place that puts the woman's mind at the center of the story and the center of the conversation.
Megan. That's funny. I tend to think of... I would have before that really thought of Jane Austen and Elena Ferrante almost as opposites in a certain way.
Explain. In
that we think of Jane Austen very much as, you know, operating with constructs like the marriage plot and that, you know, a woman's fate sort of ends with, you know, who she marries and this partnership. And again, like, the, you know, the social sort of social comedies. But I think I'm convinced that they do have something in common. I know that Ferrante has actually written about Sense and Sensibility, and I, you know, we forget that that Jane Austen herself was published pseudonymously, I believe, in her lifetime, and only later was
and cared about being anonymous too.
Yeah.
Dana, do you want to play with those connections?
Oh, sure. I mean, I love the idea about of the objective of feminism being putting women's minds at the center. One thing that I like so much about these books is that they don't feel the need to make a choice between women's intellectual life and women's sexual life, that mm-hmm. both of these things are given equal weight, because I think that there is an impulse, a self-correcting impulse to remove women's sexuality from anything that's intellectually serious or ambitious. And it's part of what makes these novels feel so rich and so complete that these facets of life, which even just in the mind-body duality are considered to be separate for men as well, but for women especially, because to be taken seriously, you must sort of erase your body is like what is, it's what gives them their depth.
Lenu in the novel is working it all out, reading, writing, studying, doubting, etc. Leela, genius that she is, gets to the answer without doing any of the homework, and she knows from the beginning exactly what her objective is. Could you describe her as an intellectual? What is the substance of her outlook? Megan.
Well, you know, I think Leela, it's interesting. These books are so much a study, you know, between this long friendship. There are so many opportunities for reversal. In the end, to me, they're very much the story of one friend and her struggle to kind of make her mark, Lenu, and then and one friend's sort of disappearance over time. What happens to a woman if you you know, deny her an education? If she's you know, her power is subverted and she tries other ways to marry well.
Can I argue that a little bit?
Sure.
She also knows from word one that her objective in life is to fight the Solaras, the Camorra.
Yes.
It defines all of her relationships, even though she halfway marries into their tribe. But it's a tong war, absolutely without restraint. And there's a perfect clarity about it, and about her mind. She's never in doubt. Doesn't that say something about what she believes? And even in terms of clearing a space, in Naples, she's drawing a line, and she's got the shoemaker's knife under one of the Solara brothers' chin, and there's not the question in anybody's mind, including his, that she will kill him to make her point.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Is the question, like, who is fighting harder? I mean, you know, their kind of parallel journeys are so interesting because, you know, one does become, you know, sort of escapes and becomes the intellectual, but even Lenu comes back and you know, finally, ultimately is the one who tells their story, but she could not have done it without Leela and Leela experiencing these things.
How does Leela experience the patriarchy and the menace, the bullying, the emptiness of that Solara rule?
Well, that's the beauty of it. We don't actually know. I think that something that tends to get forgotten is that the entire story is being told by Lenu, and there's only moments where the frame narrative is broken, and you remember that all of the story that's being told is being written by Lenu as a gesture of retaliation against her friend's desire to erase herself. And so we can, you know, as much as, you know, within the presented diegesis, you can say, oh, she reacts to it this way. But actually, everything that we learn about Leela is being told to us by Lenu. And the way that they complement each other and are different from one another is, it's very tidy. And it's you kind of learn, especially near the end of the series, when Lenu is talking about how she's terrified that Leela is working on a book, that she's been going to the library and researching the history of Naples, and she's imagining how Leela is going to write this book that's going to upstage her. And she has a breakthrough when she realizes, oh, that book, Leela's not writing that book, I'm writing that book. I'm projecting all of this onto her. So we only ever see Leela through the filter of Lenu, which complicates the narrative a lot. But as to who is the intellectual, I mean, obviously both of them are, and I think that's another beautiful thing about the stories is that, you know, there's not one, you know, women are told that if they are intellectuals, they are the exception to the rule. And so, you know, there's one way of being a female intellectual, and obviously this is not true at all. There's a million ways of being an intellectual human. But the forms of intelligence on display between them is very interesting in that Leela is an incredible quick study. She's self-taught. She can learn anything immediately and master it. But you can see her insecurity when she's interacting with Lenu, that she can't actually stick to anything. And it begins as being denied opportunity, but then she kind of doesn't see things through, and she's always worried that she'll be left behind. And what motivates her to constantly keep studying is she wants to keep up with Lenu. You know, she's the one who calls Lenu her brilliant friend.
Right.
Obviously, Lenu is like, you're my brilliant friend. That's the whole story.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, no, and just Lenu is, you know, she's, her whole thing is that she's incredibly studious. She is an incredibly hard worker, and that she thinks herself incapable of an original thought, and so she idealizes Leela's form of intelligence, which to her seems sui generis and iconoclastic, whereas hers is completely rote, which is not true, but this is how she presents her anxiety.
Dana. And Megan, we got to digress here before we're done, to speak of the violence that saturates Elena Ferrante's Naples and the book chat back in the North End, too.
The men are beating the women are beating the kids, the women are beating each other.
Mm-hmm. In the novel, Leela comes back from her honeymoon horribly smashed up by her husband, in the words of the novel.
No one, not even her mother, who was silent during the entire visit, seemed to notice her swollen black eye, the cut on her lower lip, the bruises on her arms. I took off her glasses, unwound her scarf. The skin around her eye was yellowish in color, and her lower lip was a purple stain with fiery red stripes. Besides, there was no one in the neighborhood, especially of the female sex, who did not think that she had needed a good thrashing for a long time. Mm-hmm.
Lila's young husband, Stefano, explained to friend Lenu later that, of course, his wife could never know how much he loved her unless he had smashed her to a pulp on their wedding night. And the neighborhood seemed to see it that way, too. What have we learned in all of this, Megan?
Well, from the beginning, from the, you know, the first the beginning of the first book, we see, Lila somehow, and this neighborhood is already so violent, and Lila seems to attract it. There's a point at which her father, you know, literally throws her out a window and she breaks her arm. And so part of it is, you know, we sense that this is sort of, you know, the way women are treated in this neighborhood and at this time. But it is very pointedly something about Lila as well that I think the author is showing that she sort of summons these sort of passions.
And Papa never spoke of it again.
No.
Of the broken arm, I mean.
No, exactly. But, of course, Lila is sort of dehumanized in other ways as well, not just through physical violence.
Dana Tortorici, what do we make of all that mayhem?
I think that what you make of it is that this is the violence of a poor neighborhood, and the chain of violence, you know, spills downward. So you have these men who are being, you know, treated poorly in their jobs, or they're getting swindled by the loan sharks, and then they're emasculated and belittled, and so they go home and they beat their wives, who then yell at their kids, and it's a chain of violence that, you know, kind of circle, or the, you know, it's a circle of violence that reproduces itself. But it's all about the chain of power bearing down on the family.
A chain of wrongs that generated wrongs, Lina writes, in all this violence.
And I think that, you know, the thing that Lila says is, you know, it doesn't mean anything. Like, it doesn't make sense. That's violence does not make sense. This expression of frustration and thwarted power and aggression, and it's not intelligent. And frequently, the neighborhood, the violence of the neighborhood, is conflated with, or associated with, these images of kind of like rotting liquids or like fetid, you know, just this kind of gross sewage. And it's only after being elevated out of the violence and the kind of disgusting rot of the neighborhood that you can get anywhere in your life.
Who has defended their borders, preserved their integrity by the time this incredible story sort of comes to an end? Don't spoil it for anybody, but I mean, there are victories here, are there not, Megan?
Well, certainly. I mean, in a way, you could read the book as being the thing then that Lenu herself has written, and that is the ultimate victory. And then there's the, you know, sort of the disappearance of Lila, who really does not escape. I mean, you know, the question of escape is an interesting one in the book, because Lenu does have to come home to that neighborhood after she's escaped it. And the idea that she can move up through social class only to come back home is sort of poignant and powerful.
Dana, last quick word on who won, who survives, who's standing at the end. Quickly.
Oh, everybody.
the readers are very ready for volume 5, speaking for just one of them.
Me too.
Thank you, Megan O'Grady and Dana Tortorici. And to Nilanjana Roy and Anne Goldstein. Thanks also to the expressive readers at I Am Books in the North End of Boston. I'll be there tomorrow. And to Amy McDonald's Book Club in Cambridge. Our social media team has set pieces of this show to music and images from Ferrante's Naples. For that and more, please check our website, radioopensource.org. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Abby Duker, and Philip Gara. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our maestra. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.